At the UN General Assembly today, alarm bells over Russian aggression. Many agree it's the right forum to raise it.
This issue is fundamental to the UN Charter.
But those pleas might not be landing with the same urgency as they did a year ago. Also on the program, an Iranian-American businessman was held prisoner for almost 8 years. Finally, his lawyer gets the phone call he's been waiting for.
As we saw the images on TV screens around the world of them coming off the plane in Doha, just a minute after that, he picked up the phone and called me and said, "Jared, I'm free."
Plus, in South Korea, for women, having kids can be a career killer.
Your competitive edge has become more dull by virtue of having children and having a family.
But South Korea's government thinks it might have found a solution. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for being with us. At the UN General Assembly this afternoon, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made his case for why the war in Ukraine is an existential threat far beyond his own country.
While Russia is pushing the world to the final war, Ukraine is doing everything to ensure that after Russian aggression, no one in the world will dare to attack any nation.
Earlier in the day, President Biden gave his own urgent appeal for supporting Ukraine.
If you allow Ukraine to be carved up, is the independence of any nation secure? I'd respectfully suggest the answer is no. We have to stand up to this naked aggression today and deter other would-be aggressors tomorrow.
But with the costs of the war in Ukraine adding up, how are these messages being received by the international community? We reached out to former Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg. He's the dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
I think that there are many places where the message is very strong. I think in Europe still, there's a real sense of the danger that Russia poses. But I think the big concern here is really in the United States, where there does seem to be a growing division about the importance to the United States of continuing to support Ukraine.
Is Zelensky's worldview and his warnings about the specter of World War III, are they still as convincing as they were, say, last year at this time?
I think it's less a question of the specter of World War III and more the question about, in the long run, can other countries be safe if they don't support a country that's been invaded in such a dramatic way by Russia? And I think the question that's been a recurring question over time is, can you turn the other way when there's an act of aggression if it doesn't affect you directly? And that question was posed back in the 1930s, as we all recall, and it's being posed very dramatically in the case of Ukraine today.
But in the 1930s, and then what transpired was a sort of continent-wide world war. But using the specter of a World War III, does it border on hyperbole, given that Russia's bald interest in Ukraine is an historical one? It's not to justify it, but I'm just saying that its interest in Ukraine is not a new interest. So is it valid to use this World War III analogy?
The issue of World War III is not whether Russia is going to invade and take over the world. I think the message that both Zelensky and President Biden are offering is that if the aggression goes unanswered in Ukraine, will this lead other countries to feel equally empowered to be aggressive? And we obviously can think about this in the case of China and others in the Middle East as well.
On Sunday on 60 Minutes, here's what Volodymyr Zelensky said to Scott Pelley about the threat of Russia.
If Ukraine falls, Putin will surely go further. What will the United States of America do when Putin reaches the Baltic states, when he reaches the Polish border? He will.
How does that go over with world leaders?
We know that Putin has an expansive notion about what the legitimate territory and interests are of Russia. And we've seen over many years interference in the Baltics. It hasn't led to military aggression yet, but we've certainly seen cyber attacks on the Baltic states and interference in the Baltic states. And we know that Russia has claims all along its borders in Europe and to the south. So I think there's a certain degree of credibility behind the idea that it's not just Ukraine at stake here in terms of Russia's ambitions.
Are venues like the UN General Assembly meaningful when it comes to assessing how enduring support for Ukraine is among its allies?
The UN's a complicated place, and we've seen that different countries around the world have had a different kind of reaction to this. So I think what has been more important has been our engagement with our key partners, particularly in Europe, through NATO and through our partnership with the EU. But I think what's important about what's happening in the UN, and I think President Biden underscored this in his speech, is that this issue is fundamental to the UN Charter. The very core of the whole idea of the UN was that the world would take a stand against aggression. It's enshrined in Article 2 of the Charter that sovereignty is inviolable and that countries need to stand together if we want to have a stable world to resist aggression.
But there are other instances where countries invade other countries and it doesn't get this kind of a commitment.
Well, I'm not so sure that there are that many examples of this. I think one of the great achievements of the UN over the years has been a reduction in the amount of kind of aggression of this sort of military actions across the borders. And I think it is important to vindicate this principle wherever it stands.
That's former Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg. He's now the Dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We've been talking with him about Western support for the war in Ukraine. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
After years of being held in detention inside Iran, five U.S. citizens are now free. U.S. officials say they were all wrongfully detained for political purposes. As part of the deal, the Biden administration agreed to release five Iranians held in the U.S. and to free up $6 billion of Iranian oil revenues frozen by sanctions. This deal has been long in the making, and it's not without controversy. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
As the sun was about to set in Doha, Qatar, a plane carrying five Iranian Americans touched down. The passengers stepped off the plane, tasting freedom for the first time in years. They were greeted by Qatari and American officials. There were hugs and smiles. These dual nationals had been held in Iran for years. One of them, businessman Siamak Namazi, was arrested in 2015.
It's been an extraordinary 24 hours.
Jared Genzer is an international human rights attorney. He represented the Namazi family for the past 7.5 years, pro bono.
You know, Siamak Namazi, who I've gotten to know very, very well over many years, called me both from the plane as they're about to take off, and then as we saw the images on TV screens around the world of them coming off the plane in Doha. Just a minute after that, he picked up the phone and called me and said, "Jared, I'm free."
Namazi arrived in Washington this morning. He was greeted by his family, and he's now at a military hospital undergoing medical tests. After that, Genzer says, the hard work of getting back to normal life really begins.
For so many years, you were having to just every day be worried about what comes at you. Now he has to figure out, you know, not only what does he want to do with the rest of his life, but even very basic things like getting a driver's license, opening your bank account, dealing with the Internal Revenue Service and the fact he hasn't filed taxes for years.
As part of the deal, the U.S. is releasing five Iranians charged with violating U.S. sanctions. Darren Nair has been campaigning for those held in Iran. He's a former board member of Amnesty International. Nair says what's become clear over the years is that Iran relies on hostage diplomacy to win concessions from the West.
This is part of Iran's playbook.
Iran doesn't recognize dual citizenship, so in the eyes of the Islamic Republic, any Iranian American is simply Iranian.
So what that means is they don't tell your country that they have you, and they don't allow you consular access, even though your foreign nationality is the main reason you've been arrested.
The Biden administration is coming under fire for the prisoner exchange. As part of the deal, the U.S. released $6 billion of Iranian money that was blocked in South Korea. This money is from Iranian oil sales, which fall under U.S. sanctions. Now Iran has access to those funds through a bank in Qatar. The Biden administration says Iran will only be able to use the money for food and humanitarian goods. But Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, had a different view, as he told NBC News recently.
This money belongs to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and naturally, we will decide, the Islamic Republic of Iran will decide to spend it wherever we need it.
Republican lawmakers are accusing the Biden White House of appeasement and setting the stage for future hostage-taking. Meanwhile, as the released Iranian Americans start to think about their new lives, the family of Jamshid Sharmat say they feel abandoned.
We don't have problems with the release of hostages. We're all for it. But why leaving people behind?
This is Giselle Sharmat, daughter of Jamshid Sharmat. She says her father, who was a dissident journalist and human rights advocate, was abducted from Dubai and taken to Iran. He's been sentenced to death.
They can execute him now.
Sharmat is also a German citizen. His daughter Giselle says her family hasn't received an answer as to why her father was not included in the exchange.
What are the criteria that he would have to meet to be included? You don't get a straight answer from any of these diplomats.
Sharmat says her family will continue to fight for the release of her father and other detainees in Iran. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in New York this week, taking part in the United Nations General Assembly. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Saudi Arabia has spent the past year signing a number of high-profile soccer stars with global followings. Getting a chance to see them compete in person, though, that's another story. Especially for soccer fans in nearby Iran because of a diplomatic impasse between the two countries. But now, that's all changed. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Back in 2016, diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran were severed when Riyadh executed the Iranian Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr. Gerald Feierstein of the Middle East Institute explains how the situation unraveled from there.
In retaliation, the Iranians permitted an attack on the Saudi embassy in Tehran. And as a result, the Saudis closed the embassy and withdrew their ambassador.
Those tensions spilled into the sporting world, and the Asian Football Confederation announced that soccer matches between Saudi Arabian and Iranian clubs would be played on neutral ground until the two countries made amends. For a long time, the relationship remained frosty. But Feierstein says that shifted this past March after years of negotiations.
With Chinese facilitation, they reached an agreement, and we have seen a steady move towards restoring normal ties.
Embassies reopened and ambassadors were reappointed. For soccer fans, that means one thing. Saudi and Iranian clubs can now play each other on home turf once again.
I'm so happy and so hopeful that this will bring a national happiness, national pride.
Mahdi Shariati Fezabadi is a soccer fan in Iran and heads up the sports center at the Technical and Vocational University in Tehran. He says Iranians are huge fans of the sport, which explains the public's reaction to seeing Cristiano Ronaldo this week. When Ronaldo and his team, Al Nassr, arrived in Iran, fans chased after the team's bus to get a mere glimpse of him. Hundreds of people packed his hotel lobby, chanting his name, and one starstruck kid got a hug and a signed jersey.
Yeah, let's take a picture, okay?
Ronaldo and his team take on Persepolis in Tehran today. It's the first game under the new agreement. Experts say that for Saudi Arabia, the deal is part of their wider plan to become a global sports powerhouse.
Saudi Arabia wants to demonstrate to the world that it is changing in a positive way.
Simon Chadwick is a professor of sports and geopolitical economy at Schema Business School in France.
That it's opening up, that it is trustworthy, that companies and brands can do business there.
Chadwick says that could also prove beneficial for Iran.
With the commercial development of Saudi Arabia, which is drawing in new TV audiences, is drawing in new sponsors, perhaps that might prompt some kind of change within Iran.
In other words, all of that exposure might rub off on Iran soccer clubs and attract more welcomed attention. Chadwick says matches featuring the likes of Neymar and Ronaldo will also bring an economic boost for Iran, as fans are expected to fill stadiums to see the sport's biggest stars. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In recent weeks, there's been a sharp rise in the numbers of people crossing into the U.S. from the southern border. That's a change from earlier in the summer when the Biden administration put in place stricter border rules. But that drop proved to be temporary. Encounters with U.S. Border Patrol agents have risen more than 30% over the past 2 months. The increase is especially sharp for one demographic group, as The World's Tibi's Isaiah reports.
For the first time in 4 years, families are the biggest demographic group moving across the U.S.-Mexico border. In August, more than half of the people who crossed between ports of entry did so as part of a family. Ariel Ruiz, a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute, explains why this is happening.
The majority of families that come to the U.S.-Mexico border have a significantly lower likelihood of being removed from the country than single adults.
In other words, the chance of being deported is lower for families than it is for people traveling alone. One reason for this is that family deportation requires more coordination with the country of origin of the migrants, says Ruiz.
Countries receiving them have to have an advance notice of how many families are coming so they can actually have services allowed for them. So it is an issue that is treated very carefully by the United States and by the receiving country.
But keeping families in custody is also complicated because they require more attention.
For example, if a family has been detained, they have to have a certain amount of time to be able to walk, to have exercise, activities, bonding. Mothers need to be able to nurse their children.
Ruiz says detention centers in the U.S. are not equipped to handle the number of families that are coming in. For all these reasons, family groups have been the Achilles heel for U.S. immigration enforcement for years. The Trump administration saw a similar influx of families crossing from Mexico back in 2019 and tried taking children from their parents as a deterrent. But what eventually reduced family crossings at that time was the Remain in Mexico program. It was highly criticized as inhumane because it sent thousands of asylum seekers back to dangerous Mexican cities to wait for their court dates. The Biden administration stopped this program and closed family detention centers. But that had unintended consequences, as Ariel Ruiz explains.
What this means is that under the current Biden administration policies, families are more likely to be released than they were before.
Released into the United States, and at a time when illegal crossings are heavily penalized, human smugglers are encouraging families to cross in groups. But many of these families are now being placed in swift deportation proceedings. This means families can be deported without even having a chance to go and see an immigration judge. And some advocates have criticized this policy. Lisa Koop is with the National Immigrant Justice Center.
By rushing families through these proceedings and not giving them opportunity to connect with attorneys, there's not a way for families to meaningfully seek asylum in the United States.
She says because many families are rushed through their interviews so quickly, they lose the chance to apply for asylum. The Biden administration has struggled to manage illegal border crossings. In addition to stricter rules, it created new legal ways to come to the U.S., but they only apply to migrants from certain countries with growing humanitarian crisis. Ariel Ruiz says the migrants who don't qualify for the new pathways are the ones who are mostly deciding to travel in family groups.
What's changed in July and August is that more Mexicans and more Guatemalans and Hondurans are now traveling again in families.
Ruiz says the influx of families crossing the border illegally is becoming one of the most prominent immigration challenges for the Biden administration ahead of an electoral year. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
We all know the Tour de France, but not everyone knows that it's only one of the three so-called grand tours of professional cycling. The Tour of Italy happens first, then the Tour de France, then finally the Tour of Spain, or La Vuelta a España. This year's winner was a big surprise.
Mira, Cus.
29-year-old Sepp Kuss. He's a rider for Team Jumbo-Visma. He's also the first American to win a Grand Tour in a decade. We caught up with him on the phone while he was in his car driving toward Amsterdam. Sepp, when you and your team showed up for the first day of racing in Barcelona, what was your job for the team?
Oh, to help our two main leaders, which at that time were Jonas, the winner of the Tour, and Primoz, the winner of the Giro.
So you're all on the same team, and as I understand it, you've served in this role as what's called a super domestique for them in the mountains for years, you know, helping your teammates to the podium. But this year, I know things went a little differently. On the eighth day of racing, you attacked, meaning you accelerated away from the pack and won that day's stage and put on the red jersey for the first time. What did that feel like?
Over the moon to win the stage. Most of the time, I'm doing everything to help my leaders and to get that opportunity, which was actually a strategic maneuver that day to put pressure on the other teams when I ended up leading the race. Then it opened up a whole nother dynamic in the race for me.
Now, I want to fast forward to stage 18. You're still in the red jersey. You're on the final climb to the finish, and you're following your teammates, Primoz Roglic and Jonas Vingegaard. It's just you three. Everyone else is gone. And then they start to pull away and leave you behind. What were you thinking in that moment?
I had two riders, teammates, that were also, of course, in the race to win. And I was, of course, leading the race, but caught in the middle in terms of my own personal ambitions. And when they continued, I said, just go, leave me. It's only right that we compete until the top.
The three of you hadn't made a decision about who's going to win. You just were all going for it.
We spoke actually a few days before that stage and said, yeah, we would race in a more or less defensive manner. We wouldn't attack each other. And we would race in a way where we would use the three of us against our competition. But then in that moment, when we had no other competition except for each other, then we ended up in a situation that we never expected, really.
Do you remember how you felt at that moment?
Yeah, I felt enveloped in the race and just the suffering and the focus. Once I reached the finish, I was just happy to to be at the finish. But then, of course, after the stage, I had some mixed thoughts or confusion of what things were going to look like for the remaining stages.
What did it feel like to ride into Madrid on that last day wearing the red jersey?
I'm usually on a winning Grand Tour team with guys like Primoz and Jonas, but I have to say I felt similar emotions as when I helped them versus when I was the one in the spotlight.
Sepp, is there a lesson in what you experienced at this Vuelta?
I think the biggest lesson is to stay true to who you are as a human being, whether that's the competitiveness or the humility. So for me, that was a beautiful eye-opening experience just to realize that about mostly myself.
Sepp Kuss, winner of the Vuelta a España. Sepp, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The World. If you visit Tibet today, you can see Buddhist monasteries where monks and nuns practice their religion. But Tibetans in the diaspora say those appearances can be deceiving.
The study and practice of Buddhism within the monasteries is being attacked and hollowed out.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A bombshell accusation by Canada. Yesterday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau lobbied a serious charge directly at the Indian government.
Over the past number of weeks, Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
Hardeep Singh Nijjar was a Sikh separatist leader in British Columbia. Canadian Member of Parliament Jagmeet Singh, who is also Sikh, spoke on the matter.
It is outrageous, it is shocking, and it is going to have deep and devastating impacts to Canadians.
India is denying the claims. Canadian journalist Leyland Checo is following the story from Ontario. Leyland, who was Hardeep Singh Nijjar?
Hardeep Singh Nijjar was a plumber, a father of two, but I think in the Sikh community, he was known as the president of the Gurdwara, that he was a member of, a community organizer. And I think most notably for the story, he was a very prominent member of the pro-Khalistan independence movement that we've seen has strong roots in the region where he lived.
Tell us more about the movement that he was part of. What was it about?
You know, for many Sikhs living in British Columbia who fled persecution from India, they see the Khalistani movement is kind of a response to Indian repression of the Sikh minority in India. And so Nijjar was very passionate about the idea that there could be in the Punjab an independent Khalistan state for Sikhs. And he was, you know, an incredibly vocal and passionate proponent of that movement.
Why would India want
Hardeep Singh Najjar killed.
I think India in many ways saw Mr. Najjar as a increasingly influential and powerful figure that in India's mind eroded and might have been a troubling figure for India asserting its sovereignty within its borders.
Hmm. How is the Sikh community reacting in Canada right now?
It seems as though it's a combination of disbelief, of outrage, of fear. And I think all of those reflect the fact that there is a brazenness to what happened in June. The World Sikh Organization, in a statement, said that the Prime Minister's address to Parliament confirmed what Sikhs have long known and long believed, which is that India has targeted and intimidated dissidents both inside and outside of the country. And, you know, the allegations that India hired or it was in some way responsible for the two gunmen that killed Mr. Najjar, I think has struck fear in the Sikh community because it you know makes them wonder who is safe and whether or not their political activities, which are constitutionally protected within Canada, you know, are something they can freely and without fear engage in.
We should say again that India has denied any role in the killing of Hardeep Singh Najjar. Do we know anything about the source of Canada's intelligence on this killing?
So we do know, and that Reuters recently broke this story, that the Canadian officials had been liaising with their American counterparts ahead of the announcement that the Prime Minister made yesterday. You know, Mr. Najjar had been warned allegedly by the Canadian intelligence officials earlier in the year in the days leading up to the fatal shooting. So we don't quite know what information the Canadian authorities were operating on. And I think they've said that there will be disclosures in the coming days and weeks. But, you know, it raises serious questions because I think, you know, a key part of the story is the fact that Mr. Najjar was a Canadian citizen and he was killed on Canadian soil, you know, the words of the Prime Minister, by agents of the Indian government. And so I think this has really rocked not just Canadian politics, but also I think it's justified a lot of the fear that the Sikh population in British Columbia has faced, because there has been for years fears and the belief that the Indian government does target dissidents abroad.
What has been India's official response to this?
So India has called the allegations absurd. They said they've been motivated by pro-Khalistani terrorists in the country. And they've absolutely, you know, unequivocally rejected the allegations by the Prime Minister. But India has, I think, unsurprisingly taken the steps of ejecting a Canadian senior diplomat today in response to Canada ejecting one of India's own diplomats. And so the two countries, I don't think, are in any time soon going to see eye to eye on this. And I think we've seen evidence that there is tense, you know, frosty, chilled, whatever you want to call it, relations between Canada and India. And when the Prime Minister met with Prime Minister Modi at the G20 summit in New Delhi, it seemed as though Canada was left out in the cold with the meetings with Modi. Now, obviously, we see there was a reason for that because the Prime Minister said he did raise the issue personally with Prime Minister Modi and expressed Canada's outrage.
You said there have been recent moments of tension between India and Canada, even before this allegation by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And you said they all kind of look different now in light of these revelations. What else looks different in retrospect?
Well, we got a brief from the International Trade Minister, Mary Ng, a couple days ago, saying that Canada had paused, and both sides had paused, talks on a free trade deal between the two countries. And, you know, this would have been a multi-billion-dollar trade deal. I think there was a lot of excitement that it could be, you know, signed and ratified by the end of the year. And so there was a bit of confusion over why we were seeing this pause. And when the Prime Minister was in New Delhi, that he was never really given that kind of pull aside with Prime Minister Modi that other leaders of the G20 received. And you know, he wasn't mentioned in a number of the readouts. But I think you do now, in retrospect, get a sense that the Canadian government did obviously raise this issue with the Indian officials and senior Indian leadership. I think that goes to explain why we haven't seen much movement in the last few weeks on what until now has been a fairly important trade file.
So what happens next in this tiff? It's a pretty serious one.
You know, this morning, the U.S. and the U.K. have both thrown their support behind Canada investigating and holding whoever is responsible to account. And so I wouldn't be shocked if in the next few days or weeks, we do see a bit of an escalation diplomatically. And that could take the form of kind of also a bit of a trade kind of row that could unfold. But I think what happens next is a bit up in the air. But I can't imagine that either side, especially the Canadian side, is kind of eager to kind of inflame tensions more.
Leyland Checo is a reporter based in Toronto. Thank you, Leyland.
Thanks for having me.
South Koreans are some of the hardest working people in the world. Corporations there demand long hours, and the pressure to succeed can be intense. It's one reason why many young South Koreans decide not to have kids. They simply don't have the time. But the government is now making families a priority. It wants to entice white-collar workers to have more children, and officials are ready to try out a controversial experiment to make that happen. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
In the 1960s, the average South Korean woman had 6 kids. Now, the average is less than 1. And for those who choose not to, who can blame them?
Your competitive edge has become more dull by virtue of having children and having a family.
That's Min-hee Go, articulating the fears of many Koreans. She's a political scholar at Ewha Women's University. South Korea has seen the fastest decline in fertility of any country, perhaps ever. It's a huge issue. But Professor Go says the causes are not mysterious. In Korean office culture, taking time off to care for a sick child or just taking paternity leave can be taboo.
There still is this widespread notion that bringing family business to work is quite unprofessional and nuisance to coworkers.
Then there are old-fashioned gender expectations.
Fathers go out, make money, and work for long hours. Mothers stay at home raising kids.
Dishes, diapers, laundry. Professor Go says it's often seen as work for women. They can sacrifice their careers or try to raise kids and work. The mayor of Seoul, Oh Se-hoon, said in a recent speech, society can't go on like this much longer. The mayor says experts warn that with this fertility rate, Korea could be the first country to disappear. But he has a solution, foreign nannies. It's broadly illegal to bring domestic workers into South Korea, but the city of Seoul is going to adjust the rules with a new pilot program, letting 100 domestic workers come in from the Philippines. They'll arrive sometime before the end of the year and stay at least 6 months. Min-hee Go says it's an experiment pitched to ambitious South Koreans who are on the fence about having kids.
Foreign maids may help sustain a mother's career, which may or may not boost the fertility rate.
This is not a new idea. South Korean officials are studying 2 other places in Asia, Singapore and Hong Kong, where it's typical for upper middle class families to rely on live-in domestic workers, often from the Philippines. But Hong Kong and Singapore combined are smaller than Seoul, a city with a population of 26 million. So it's important for South Korea to get this right before it scales up, because Filipina nannies have a history of facing exploitation, namely falling victim to dodgy agents who send them overseas and extract half their pay or more.
If they have debt before they even start working, then that just creates a cycle that they cannot break out of.
Kathleen Largo is with the Fair Employment Foundation in Hong Kong, a rare nonprofit agency for domestic workers set up to avoid exploitation. Parents who take foreign workers into their homes need training, Largo says, and officials should enforce basic rules. Like, yes, a worker can sleep in a room with a kid only if the kid is younger than 12. And no, you can't put a camera in the room or forbid them from dating outside the house. Other essential guidelines include 1 day off per week and a room no smaller than 35 square feet with a lock.
You know, if you cannot provide suitable accommodation for a helper, then maybe you should not get a domestic worker.
A lot of South Korean families just don't meet that criteria. The city of Seoul is crowded. Couples are squeezed into tiny apartments. It's only wealthy people that have spare rooms. And on top of all that, South Koreans are still getting used to having foreign workers in their country, never mind living inside their homes. Again, here's Professor Min-hee Go.
The important condition here is that they should be able to communicate well enough and the pay should be reasonable.
She says foreign nannies, if hired ethically, may be a good solution for well-to-do couples. But officials in Seoul want this project to have broad appeal. One lawmaker proposes letting parents pay foreign nannies only half the minimum wage, about $800 a month. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen.
8 days ago, in the early morning hours, a wall of water plowed through a city in northeast Libya. This phone video was taken from an upper floor of a building in Derna, Libya. The woman here is saying, "Oh God, oh God." Thousands of people were killed in the floodwaters that day. Scientists say climate change is partly to blame. A new report estimates that the deluge was 50 times more likely to happen because of global warming. The study, published today, spells out the connections between climate change-driven rainfall and its impact on the Mediterranean region. Mariam Zakaria is the lead author of the report for World Weather Attribution. The WWA studies the possible influence of climate change on extreme weather events. We reached her in London. Mariam Zakaria, the extreme rainfall earlier this month around the Mediterranean left thousands of people dead in Libya, where Storm Daniel dropped 16 inches of rain in 24 hours. How accurate were weather predictions before the storm?
We look at both observations and models to understand the link between climate change and the kind of rainfall amounts that we have seen. But we do not know how prepared the communities were in terms of anticipating the amount of rainfall that fell and what it would mean in terms of impacts.
So the weather predictions were correct, but it's not clear how informed people were about what was coming and therefore how to prepare or evacuate.
That's right.
Now, the study concludes that human-caused warming made the heavy rainfall up to 10 times more likely in Greece, Bulgaria, and Turkey, and up to 50 times more likely in Libya. Tell me how you reached those conclusions.
When we say that the event has been made 10 times more likely, what it means is that the event that we saw this year would have been much, much rarer. So a 1-in-10-year event in this year, the chances of such an event occurring in a world without climate change would have been, 1 out of 300. And this change in likelihood is because of the warming, the human-induced warming, which has resulted in increased chances of rainfall.
I see. Now, to be clear, the flash floods in Libya happened because two major dams there gave way. Are scientists able to say how much the additional rain brought by climate change was to blame for that?
Well, it is difficult to say right away and to give an absolute number, but these dams are relatively new. They were built in the 1970s, and we do not know for sure whether the dams were built to withstand such high amounts of rainfall. So we will know these facts only as post-impact assessments are done.
I know that some members of your team focused on infrastructure. In Libya, for example, the dams that gave way were not being maintained. Can you talk more about the importance that infrastructure plays as climate change makes the weather more extreme?
When we talk about climate change, it also means that we need to keep revising the design criteria. So for dams, when you build a dam, when you build such an infrastructure, one of the important factors that you need to consider is what is the amount of rainfall that is expected to come into these reservoirs and at what level would it start overflowing. So these design levels are very important. For example, if a dam is built to withstand a flood or a rainfall of 1 in 100 years, the same 1 in 100 year in a past climate, which would have been cooler, would entail a smaller amount as compared to now. So we need to keep revising the design criteria, the design levels, so that we can maintain these infrastructures.
These weather disasters, they're happening more and more frequently. What should we be expecting in the coming years?
Until we can, stop burning fossil fuels completely and we can move towards a zero carbon transition, we can expect these events to become more frequent. So in the way we understand how especially extreme rainfall and temperatures behave, we know that as the planet warms, we can expect an increasing trend in both extreme precipitation and in temperatures. But it will be to varying degrees in different regions. But we can certainly expect such events to become more frequent in the future, and we need to think about ways to adapt, or we need to make that a priority going forward while we work towards mitigating these effects in the long term.
Mariam Zachariah is a researcher at the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and the Environment at Imperial College in London. She's been talking to us about the links between climate change and the catastrophic rainfall that led to thousands of deaths from flooding in Libya. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you for having me on your show.
A group of Tibetan Buddhist monks living in exile in India is on a sacred arts tour this month here in the United States. They're demonstrating an ancient artistic and spiritual practice, creating big, colorful sand mandalas. The monks say that Buddhist traditions like this are under threat because of Chinese government policies in their historic homeland of Tibet. The World's Amanda Lichtenstein reports from outside of Chicago.
Inside a sun-filled room at the Lake Street Church in Evanston, Illinois, seven Tibetan monks in maroon and saffron robes are seated on the floor, leaning over a big blank blue canvas. They're plotting out the creation of an elaborate sand mandala. It's a circular religious painting made of colorful sands that will take the monks 5 days to complete. They're on a multi-state sacred arts tour from Drepung Gomang Monastery in southern India. This is a fundraising effort and a demonstration of a religious practice that's about beauty, prayer, and meditation. They start at the center, scraping tiny grains of sand onto the canvas. The design includes symbols from different world religions, Christian, Hindu, Jewish, Native American, Islamic, and others. Here's Sangyal Gyatso, one of the monks, speaking through an interpreter.
So there are different types of mandala, and this one specifically is for war, peace, and religious harmony. And then before we create this mandala, we will have a little puja that will pray for world peace.
This group of senior monks between the ages of 40 and 56 were all born in Tibet. They escaped on foot and resettled in India, where Tibet's most prominent Buddhist monasteries have been reestablished since 1959. That's when Tibetans revolted against Chinese rule, and the Dalai Lama fled Tibet and set up a government in exile in India. The head monk with this tour is Kenrup Choden. He carries an official Indian ID card as a Tibetan refugee. He says the monks here are concerned about what's happening back in Tibet.
So as we all know, after the 1959, Tibetan culture, language, religion, it still was under a huge threat, and it's still under a huge threat, especially the people inside of Tibet.
He says it's important for Americans to get a glimpse of traditional Tibetan Buddhist practices that are now endangered. Robbie Barnett is a UK-based Tibet scholar and researcher at the School of Oriental and Asian Studies. He says there was a brief period of expanding religious freedom in Tibet back in the 1990s. But since then, the Chinese government has been introducing strict new controls for the way Buddhism is practiced.
These regulations are continuing to come out. They're continuing to limit who can become a monk. And you're not allowed now in central Tibet to become a monk or a nun unless a previous one has died or left the order. They've capped the numbers of monks and nuns, and they've capped the numbers of monasteries. So it's very, very difficult now.
Barnett says the Chinese government now appoints Communist Party officials to live inside monasteries. They make sure the monks are following certain ideological guidelines.
They have to love China. They have to love China more than they love religion. They have to believe that the law of the land is more important than the law of religion. They have to believe that citizens are more important than monks and nuns. This is a kind of new development, a new kind of slogan, if you like. They have to be ready to act at any moment of crisis, which means that we think this means that if there's a protest or any kind of dissent, they have to inform the authorities of that dissent.
In late August, the U.S. State Department announced visa restrictions for Chinese officials in response to government policies in Tibet. Specifically, the U.S. mentioned forcible assimilation of Tibetan school kids in state-run boarding schools. Lawdon Tetong is the director of the Tibet Action Network. She sees the schools as part of a larger effort to erase Tibetan language, culture, and religious practices.
China shows and gives this appearance of religious freedom in Tibet because you see monks and you see, you know, if you go to Tibet, you'll see monks, you'll see monasteries, you'll see people going to the monasteries. What is not as clear is that the study and practice of Buddhism within the monasteries is being attacked and hollowed out.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin recently denied accusations of forced assimilation at schools in Tibet. He called this pure fabrication and said that China fully protects the rights and freedoms of all ethnic groups, including freedom of language and religion. Back at the church in Evanston, the monks are reciting final prayers and putting the finishing touches on the sand mandala. The last ritual of the week is to ceremoniously destroy what they just spent 5 days creating. It's a lesson in life's impermanence, the monks tell me. For Barb Vaughn, a member of the Lake Street Church, there's profound wisdom in what the monks are doing here.
For them to be able to create something so beautiful and not get attached to it is a model for me. Because I can think about it intellectually, but emotionally, we want to acquire things and hold on to them. So it's a good lesson.
And just like that, the monks ceremoniously sweep up the mandala into a blur of colors. Later, they put on vibrant yellow ceremonial hats and process to Lake Michigan, where Kenrop Choden pours the leftover sacred sand into the water. And the monks recite one final prayer for peace. For the world, I'm Amanda Lichtenstein, Evanston, Illinois.
That story is part of our ongoing Sacred Nation reporting series. It's funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. And you can find the series online at theworld.org/sacrednation. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.